Well, after two such eloquent presentations, I feel that I've been given a very broad canvas to work with, but I'm going to be a miniaturist. I'm going to talk about one particular technology, primarily, and a piece of legislation. Lord Sharman's quite correct. I'd like to tell you a little bit about a piece of legislation that's going through Parliament at the moment. Before I do that, I think I should explain a little bit of background about the Foundation for Information Policy Research. We were established about 2 years ago, and it grew from a collection of people who'd become interested in the question of cryptography policy, which I'll be mentioning. And if you like, our approach, we like to think is distinctive because we try and analyse, first of all, an issue from a technological perspective. We try and obtain a good understanding of the technological developments already in the pipeline and the scientific limitations that we can foresee, and then work outwards to the social and economic implications to see if we can draw in existing expertise and link that up with our technical analysis. So fundamentally, it's a bottom-up approach from the technology. And we feel that's still distinctive in many ways in the public policy arena. Before I launch into some of the policy, I think it's worth saying why I'm going to talk so much about cryptography. And the reason is that our analysis is that it does actually lie at the heart of many of the questions about technology and society and crime. In the field of virtual goods, of data, not of physical goods, I'm not really going to be addressing those questions. And it's also true, and one recognises, that in the context of the technological developments that may occur in the next 20 years, although these are big potatoes at the moment, they may be small potatoes in the long run, but one can't foresee that. But the reason I want to talk about cryptography is because lay people coming to the field and thinking about how one carries forward the regime, say, for interception of communications, are wont to make a number of entirely reasonable assumptions, which are wrong. Cryptography at the heart has a number of fundamentally counterintuitive discoveries, which, unless one understands at the outset, one will go very severely awry in one's policy analysis. So I'd like to start off with a fairly hackneyed cocktail party story. You're at a cocktail party, and you want to tell a message to somebody the other side of the room. You have to speak out loud, and you don't want anybody else in the room to understand you. So you can obviously use some sort of code. You can drop into the conversation such a sort of nonchalant phrase as, "My armadillo has tonsillitis," and everyone will accept this as a perfectly normal part of the conversation. And only the intended recipient will understand its true meaning. But obviously they can only understand its true meaning if you've met up beforehand and agreed some sort of code, a shared secret. But supposing I was to tell you that wasn't necessarily so, is there a way to conduct such a sort of cocktail party communication without meeting up with somebody in secret beforehand? Well, quite clearly there is, otherwise we wouldn't be telling a story. But how many people, just to gauge in the room, understand what I'm talking about here? Okay. Right, good. Okay. Well, if I was to tell you that the people in the room are wearing T-shirts, and on the T-shirts have very long numbers written on them, and conceptually, the way you avoid meeting up beforehand and sharing a secret is you take your message, you put it into your pocket calculator or your programmable computer, and you wrap it up in a certain way with a number on the T-shirt of the person you want to send it to, and you then utter this mathematical combination number which has been scrambled up, and the person receives it. And that person knows a number corresponding to the number on their T-shirt in some sort of intricate mathematical way, not the number itself, which then allows them to sort of disentangle this message. Now, because the two numbers, the number on the T-shirt and the number that they only know, that they know, have this delicate mathematical relationship, and because you've targeted or you've wrapped up the message in a customized way aimed at the particular person, it means that nobody else in the room, unless they know the hidden number or the private key, let's call a spade now, nobody else can understand it. Now, that's a very surprising fact, at least I think it should be, that you can share a secret message in such a way without sharing a secret. And this discovery was made about 20 years ago by an American mathematician, and about 5 years before that, in fact, in GCHQ, by a new Cambridge graduate. And not very much happened to the idea until the arrival of the internet. Now, what this idea allows you to do over the internet is it means you can engage in secure electronic commerce. Because imagine if such a technology didn't exist. You would then have to operate in a sort of Enigma, World War II cipher machine sort of style, where if you wanted a large number of people to receive the same message in secret, you'd actually have to devise a courier system to distribute key material to each of them identically. And there's no point sending that key material over the same channel that you use for the message, because if you're worried about that channel being eavesdropped on, then clearly that's no good. However, now you've got a way of setting up a key between two parties without sharing a secret out of band, then you can set up a closed, confidential channel of communication, point-to-point, anyone-to-anyone, with no further ado. And it's this which really enables electronic commerce. If you didn't have this ability, I guess you could have electronic commerce, but everything would have to be centralized, run out of some sort of government key distribution center, which supervised the distribution of this key material and allowed these exchanges to happen. And I think it's here where the assumption that has led to a lot of policy difficulties over the past few years has arisen. If one's talking about interception of communications, there is a telephone company, and they do have a switching center which routes all communications. And therefore, governments have, for reasons of expediency, not particularly for any principled legal reason, have intercepted communications under various regimes of oversight and control, and they have been able to do so. Once one has end-to-end cryptography, where the keys are under the control of the parties themselves engaging in communication, it's the carrier isn't in a position to intercept, because although they can deliver the content of the communications, if that content is encrypted, only the person who knows the private key at either end is in a position to decrypt. That's the fundamental problem with encryption, the problem from government's point of view. So over the past few years, the approach that's been taken and has been seen to fail was called key escrow, and this was the idea that people who would communicate confidentially with public key encryption, as this technique's called, should deliver up in advance a copy of the key, the private key, to government. Now, the fairly obvious flaw in the scheme is that if you can download encryption programs from the internet as software, then it seems unlikely that criminals will volunteer their keys in advance to allow themselves to be monitored. There are a number of other policy objections on economic grounds and technical grounds and so forth, but the long and the short of it is that key escrow has, for the time being, failed. It's not being done here. It's not being done anywhere else. Britain was actually the last country to abandon this policy, formally in March 1999. What's happening now? Well, in Parliament at the moment, there's a bill called the Regulation of Investigatory Powers, and part of it is concerned with updating the regime for interception of communications to cover internet service providers under a common umbrella of communication service providers. And there are arguments about cost, the burdens to be imposed on internet service providers, but I don't think there's actually very much disagreement with the principle that, I mean, it sort of can't really be argued that the internet should somehow be immune from interception. The second part deals with regulation of human informers, human intelligence sources, which is something that has been proved to be required by the European Convention of Human Rights. And the third part is to do with encryption. And what the bill does is it creates a power deriving from, if you like, the underlying authorization, be that from a Secretary of State in the case of interception warrants, or from a judge in the case of a search warrant, say a PACE warrant. Deriving from that power, it creates the ability for various people to serve a decryption notice. And a decryption notice, pretty much what it sounds, it requires the person either to deliver up the unencoded or de-encoded or decrypted communication or a key, which will do so at the discretion of the authorities concerned. Now, the big bust-up, if you like, has been the way in which this has been formulated legally. As currently drafted, what happens if somebody says that they've lost or forgotten a key or a passphrase? At the moment, and accepting the argument about the future for biometrics and so forth, but at the moment, the way in which cryptography is used is a keys are protected by a passphrase. In other words, so somebody just can't wander up to your PC, put in a floppy disk, and pinch the key is itself encrypted on the disk with a passphrase. The passphrase is mashed up and used in a conventional encryption way to protect the key. So if you want to get at somebody's communications, you've got to know the passphrase, or you've got to know the unencrypted or the real key. But because people can't remember numbers of several hundred digits, the way in which it's done at the moment is you type in a passphrase. And you have to you choose a passphrase which can't be guessed by machine, so it's got to be sufficiently long, and it can't be in some sort of dictionary which could be automatically generated and cracked. So it's got to be idiosyncratic enough to remember. So, I mean, there is industry research which suggests that about 10% of people not only forget passwords or passphrases, but actually do so in such a way that they lose data permanently. And it seems to us that passing a law isn't really going to change that. So the way which the RIP bill is formulated is if you say that you have lost or forgotten a passphrase, then you have to prove that on the balance of probabilities. The normal criminal standard of the prosecution having to show its case beyond reasonable doubt doesn't apply. So how does one show that you've forgotten something on the balance of probabilities? Well, I'm not going to give you an answer to that question because I honestly don't know. It's a question we've been asking the Home Office for about 8 months now. And we're getting answers like, well, it's going to depend on your general credibility. It's going to depend on when you last used your passphrase. You're going to have to sort of account for what happens if you do, in the past, have lost passphrases. And this seems to us all very well, and certainly there can be sort of circumstantial tests of veracity that you can imagine flowing out of that, but it doesn't really touch the basic problem, that people do forget passphrases, people do have good and bad memories in all sorts of ways. And the other factor is that no other country is taking this approach. In fact, no other country is actually creating explicit decryption powers, which have, you know, two pages of law dealing with the phenomenon of encryption. Singapore and India do actually have a one-liner national security sort of provision requiring people to decrypt. But there's no question of reversing the burden of proof. I should actually add that the Home Office, it's still contentious, this phrase, the burden of proof. The Home Office still maintains, and in fact there is no reversal of the burden of proof. So I should perhaps correctly, in a neutral way, say that the law is phrased so that you have a statutory defense which requires you to show on the balance of probabilities that the key has been lost or forgotten. So I think the dilemma was well put by the Conservative opposition front bench spokesman in Standing Committee, which has just finished, when he said that the real trouble with this defense is it's what the prosecution has to show is neutral between guilt and innocence. There's no guilty mind. Well, let's suppose that one put the burden of proof on the prosecution to show beyond reasonable doubt that somebody did have a key and was, in some sense, willfully withholding it. How do you do that? Well, it seems clear that you'd have, in some sense, to be able to point to the key and say, oh ho, you're lying, there's the key, and you told us you didn't have it, but actually you do. And it seems to us, in almost all operational circumstances, that what the police and the agencies would prefer to do in those circumstances is to use other powers of covert surveillance to maintain the ability to survey data secretly and basically pinch a copy of the key, which can be done under warrant, for example, under the Police Act 1996. So either way you formulate it, decryption powers don't seem to make a lot of sense. And, you know, I'm not going to beat around the bush. What we estimate is that this is a government which is worried about having a spotlessly robust, shall we say, position on law and order issues. And they don't want to be in a position where political flak could be thrown at them if there was another Gary Glitter case which involved encryption. We believe that is the rather unpleasant bargain that has been struck inside the Home Office. Now, this bill, as I said, has just completed Standing Committee. It will shortly go through report stage, and no concessions on this central issue have been offered. Well, I'd like to use the remaining time to broaden the debate slightly. What are the alternatives? If encryption may be such a problem for law enforcement, if interception of communications is so critical to the fight against drugs and the fight against organized crime, what are the law enforcement agencies supposed to do? Are we talking about really reversing a fundamental tenet of our system of justice? Is that the only alternative? Well, we believe not. The reality today and for the foreseeable future is that computing platforms are hopelessly insecure. hardly a week goes by, depending which newspapers you read, when some new weakness in the security of the design of leading operating systems isn't discovered and well publicized. And for various technical and economic reasons, this is quite unlikely to change. So I think the approach that we're generally recommending as an alternative is we foresee law enforcement entering into an arms race where they are going to have to apply such resources in such mass that they're able to develop technical ways to subvert encryption at the endpoints. Now, this could include various types of hardware bugs, various sorts of software bugs which can tunnel into the operating system, exploit weaknesses from the outside. But we have to then ask a basic question. Is this scenario preferable in any way to the sort of overturning of civil rights that the other approach entails? Well, I believe it is. And the reason is because such methods have a sort of intrinsic locality to them that the sort of data collection on a broad scale, the sort of unlimited scope for harnessing analysis of traffic data, communications data, that is to say who's talking to whom rather than what they're saying, together with content into a sort of integrated intelligence system that you really have to call a blueprint for Big Brother. The methods of subverting operating system security are local, and they can be much more easily supervised and overseen. And our belief is that, from the big picture point of view, if encryption turns out to be such a big problem for law enforcement, going down the route of comprehensive interception capabilities and comprehensive data collection creates instability. It's our belief that for the stability of society as a whole and to protect against events in the future, it's much better to dilute concentrations of power rather than centralize it, and certainly not to jump out of a plane with a parachute that no other country is planning to use and which we don't know if it's going to open. Thanks very much.